Hi everyone, I hope you're having a happy and safe Thanksgiving weekend. Today is a rebroadcast of an earlier episode with performance psychologist Noah Kageyama. Noah is on faculty at the Juilliard School, and he's the creator of the Bulletproof Musician blog, where he teaches musicians how to practice more effectively and beat nerves and pressure on stage. While it's accepted that elite athletes need to have mental health support in order to reach their peak performance levels, the idea that classical musicians might also need a little help too is a pretty recently accepted practice. In fact, I remember that when I was in school, whenever I asked for help from my teachers with things like stage fright, memory slips, and well, just general tips on how to be awesome on stage, they'd look at me with panic in their eyes, like I'd grown a second head. Thankfully, this is changing. And Noah is a pioneer in the field of performance psychology that's geared especially for classical musicians. And regardless of whether you are a musician or not, I think you'll gain insights from listening to this chat with Noah. Thanks for listening. Noah is a former violinist who specializes in teaching performing artists how to utilize sports psychology principles to more consistently demonstrate their full abilities under pressure. He has been featured in the Wall Street Journal, Musical America, Strings Magazine, Strad, and Lifehacker. He maintains a private coaching practice and writes a performance psychology blog called The Bulletproof Musician, which has more than 100,000 monthly readers. So I thought we would start by just talking about when you were two and when you started playing the violin. I know that's something you write about on your blog. Can you talk about when you started and why?
Yeah, so I mean, this is before my memory really allows me to recall what actually happened. But as my mom tells it, I, from a very early age, would say, "Oa waik muvas," or something along those lines. And one of the first things my parents bought when they got married and moved into an apartment was a record player and a piano. So there was music in the home, and neither of them were musicians. But I think they, you know, had the obligatory piano lessons growing up and liked music and valued it. So I'd been hearing music, and so when I started saying that, my mom had no idea what it meant. But one day at a neighbor's house, I said, "Nice mugas," when music was playing. And so they kind of put two and two together and figured out I was saying, "I like music." And as it happens, my cousins in Ithaca, New York, were some of the first guinea pigs, if you will, with, you know, the Suzuki program that was getting started out at Ithaca College. And so my mom's like, "Oh, well, maybe he could play violin then." And so one summer we went out, and I was in the summer Suzuki program there and learned how to bow to a D major chord and, you know, hold the dowel rod and Cracker Jack box with a ruler tape to it as my start. And that's when I was about 2.5. And so it, you know, kind of continued from there, because I was growing up in Central Ohio, and Capital University had a new Suzuki program starting up as well. And so I started taking lessons there and got an actual tiny, I think it's a, can't remember if it was 1/32nd size or 1/16th size, but it was a tiny little violin.
Oh, cute.
And yeah, and it just kind of went from there. When my mom started reading Dr. Suzuki's books that he was writing in Japanese, she got really interested in this philosophy of his and this method that he was developing and this process. And so she like cold called him and sent him letters, and eventually managed to get him to agree to take me on as a student if we showed up in Matsumoto, Japan. And so midway through kindergarten, she took me out of school, and we flew over and spent like 6 to 8 months over there living and me taking lessons with him and his assistants and sitting in on classes and being part of those like play-ins of, like, you know, hundreds of people all at once.
Wow.
So yeah, so that was my start.
Oh my gosh. So you actually studied with Dr. Suzuki. I didn't know that.
Yeah, no, I have memories of him, you know, smoking and being really kind and like doing, you know, goofy things like putting his briefcase on my elbow so that I would understand the concept of bow weight instead of bow pressure. And I think I threw a paper airplane in the hall and hit him in the back of the head by accident once, and like threw it back at me and, you know, played for a little bit. So yeah, I mean, I have fond memories of being there.
Wow, that's incredible. I mean, 2.5 is really young to have started, even by like current standards when kids start pretty young. Do you remember what motivated you to keep playing? Did you just really love playing the violin, or do you have any recollections of that? Because it sounds like you were performing right off the bat pretty early because you went to Japan and did the play-ins and stuff.
I don't remember what my motivations were other than it was what my parents or my mom was telling me to do. So I was like, all right, I'll do it. And I do remember having moments where, you know, so my mom got herself a, you know, full size cheap violin so she could play along with me. And, and my dad, you know, can basically play Christmas carols on the piano. Like he remembers that much from his piano. And so, you know, so they would try to play along with me. So I wasn't just playing by myself and practicing by myself. And I do remember that being fun. And we have cassette recordings of us doing that and kind of laughing and so forth. So I do remember that part of it, but I also remember it being at times, you know, tiring, frustrating, or just obviously as a 3-year-old or 5-year-old, there are times where you'd rather go out in the yard and look for turtles in the pond with your friends and do whatever they're doing instead of having to stay inside and go through this to-do list of pieces and scales and etudes and so forth. And so I remember both, and I'm not sure what tipped the balance one way or the other, but there are certainly good times and tough times.
And was there an early success that was important to you from those years? I mean, I guess before maybe high school or college, was there an early success that you remember?
I mean, I think success is all relative, but, you know, given where I was, you know, I was growing up in a small town in the middle of Ohio, and was doing a lot of commuting. You know, we're driving to Columbus all the time for lessons, and in middle school, I was driving to Chicago for lessons. And, you know, certainly, you know, getting to play with some orchestras in the area and, you know, winning, you know, not international competitions or anything huge, but certainly doing well in those sorts of ways. And I mean, you know, even from a young age, I remember, I think it was probably like 5, and, you know, this film crew came to our house and filmed me for this local, like Columbus, I forget what it was called, but it was like, you know, front page Saturday night or something, kind of like a human interest kind of 30-minute show, sort of like, I think Extra might be that kind of show. I don't know if it's still on, that kind of show. And so there were moments where certainly I was getting a lot of attention for what I was doing, which I also don't really remember because now I'm not hugely fond of getting attention. But as a kid, I also think I was a little bit, I'm not shy, but just sort of not interested in seeking out the limelight. But yeah, so there were moments where certainly objectively things were going pretty well for me.
So it sounds like you were performing from a pretty young age with some professional success. And you write on your blog that you discovered somewhere along the way that, quote, discipline, sacrifice, and practice weren't quite enough. Because you struggled with the inconsistency and a feeling that your playing often fell short of what you knew you were capable of. Can you tell me about an instance where, quote, it was frustrating to play so well in rehearsals and then sound like a different person in performances and auditions?
It was the consistency of that phenomenon that started to frustrate me after a while. I think at first I just accepted it, right? Like you go on stage and maybe you have a little memory slip or things are not quite as in tune as they were when you were practicing the day before. And especially when there wasn't a huge amount of pressure and there wasn't much at stake, you know, performing at, you know, local nursing homes or just in front of your teacher's other students. So it was annoying, but it wasn't that problematic to me in the grand scheme of my life at the time. But then when I started doing, you know, bigger competitions like MTNA or ASTA, or, you know, the ones where people come from different states, and there's a little bit more at stake in terms of what opportunities could await you if you win. And when those performances really fell short of what I knew I could do, then it started being more than annoying, but really kind of frustrating. And I did a lot of introspection to try to figure out, you know, what's going on. And the initial thought was that I just needed to practice more because obviously I wasn't practicing as much as I could have, and my teachers would always want to see me practice more. And so I kind of entertained that as, okay, worst case scenario, maybe I'll do that. Because I think even from that age, I wasn't a huge fan of, you know, just drilling things and practicing the metronome and doing things over and over and over. Mm-hmm. So I think it was really more when I started to get into high school and the stakes were a little bit higher and there was more opportunity if I did well, that it really started to frustrate me that there was such a gap or drop off between what I sounded like in practice and what I sounded like on stage. And obviously, you know, the nerves were a little bit more prominent then as well. And so even when I started practicing more, what made everything more frustrating is that it's not like practicing more necessarily led to better performances. I mean, sometimes I wouldn't be that well prepared at all. I'd still play better even if I was nervous. And so I couldn't quite figure out what the equation was between practicing and nerves and performance on stage. And so that uncertainty made it all the more frustrating, mm-hmm. especially when there are times where things worked really well and I had no idea why, and I couldn't replicate that formula, whatever it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it seems like that sort of threatens your sense of like agency. So I can really relate to what you're describing because I've definitely had those experiences as well. And, you know, achieving mastery at a really high level in classical music requires folks to begin training at a really young age. And I mean, you started really young at 2, like I started at 5 and a half, which compared to you, wasn't that young. Because of this, I often found that I conflated my sense of myself, my identity, with my success or failure as a performer. And so when I experienced what you described, this kind of, it's one way in the practice room and then it's totally different in front of people, it really kind of shook me. I struggled with feelings of that somehow I wasn't good enough and that was the reason why, like that everybody else was just better. Is this like a fairly common phenomenon that you find with folks in classical music, that they kind of confuse the doing of what they're doing with their personhood, with who they are?
I think absolutely. And it's probably not just classical musicians, but anyone who starts doing something at a really young age that becomes a central focus in their life. For better or for worse, anytime we start something really young, and especially if we get attention for it, and it becomes a big part of what we spend our time on, it's easy for that sense of self to get really attached to what it is that we do, whether it's in athletics or music or something else even. And I think there's a moment in the Seymour Bernstein film that Ethan Hawke produced where he talks about this being something that he experienced as well. And so I think it's not unusual for musicians, athletes who start at a young age to experience that sort of thing. And as you were asking the question, I was trying to remember what my experience of it was. And I'm sure there was a time, especially when I was younger, where, you know, if you don't play in tune or you have a bad lesson or you just don't even have a good practice session, you feel like you're just not a good person that day. Yeah. And you hope that the next day is a better day and you'll be a better person. Especially if, you know, even in the practice room where things just don't seem to be getting better and you start maybe having this doubt inside your head that, well, maybe it's just not going to get any better. Maybe that's as good as it gets for me. And starting to then feel like you kind of suck as a person because clearly you're not good enough to play the Tchaikovsky Concerto in tune or whatever it may be.
Can you tell me about when and how you decided to step away from the violin and move in a different direction with your career, and talk a little bit about what that transition was like for you?
Yeah, and this is where I was thinking, I was trying to reflect back on what my experience was with how much I identified with being a musician, because by the time I got to grad school, I mean, the assumption was that I was going to be a musician. I mean, that's why I went to Juilliard, and that's what I'd always planned on doing from the time I was a pretty young kid. But I had this detour in college at Oberlin where, in order to get out of orchestra, I exploited this loophole of the double degree program where, in theory, you graduate after 5 years with a degree in the conservatory and a degree in the college. Mm-hmm. But all I wanted to do was get a degree and not play an orchestra. And so I pretended to do the double degree program and meanwhile fulfilled all the requirements for a psychology degree so that I would be able to graduate, you know, in 4 years, still take lessons, do chamber music, but not take theory or music history or orchestra and still have a degree. So I kind of delayed the experience of being a musician by about 4 years, or at least being really immersed in the life of a musician for 4 years, because all my friends, for the most part, were in the college and, you know, I hung out on a different part of campus than most of the conservatory students hung out in. I didn't go to the conservatory building except to take lessons and to practice when I had to. So it might have been that during the time I on some level maybe started disidentifying a little bit with being a musician, because when I got to Juilliard, even though, you know, I had friends there that I'd known since I was a kid, you know, from summer festivals and so forth, somehow it felt like I didn't quite belong in the way that I thought I would. And music didn't feel as much me, maybe, as I thought it would or thought it did. I remember having this gig quartet that I was in, and we were just kind of joking about what we'd do if we won the lottery, because I think the lottery was really high at that particular time when we were eating lunch. And all of them had ideas for things they would do in music. They would just use music or the money that they would get from the lottery to further their goals and the things that they wanted to experience in music. And I was the only one who, like, without a doubt, I knew that I wouldn't play anymore. Like, I'd put the violin away instantly, and I didn't know what I would do. I had no idea, but I knew that I wouldn't play anymore. And so I was so mystified by the fact that they would keep playing, because they wouldn't have to anymore, right? They're millionaires. So that's when I started realizing that, okay, maybe this assumption I had that everybody's going to quit if they win the lottery, maybe that assumption was incorrect, and that was just me that would quit. And so I kind of stewed on that for a while and tried to figure out what that meant. Because on the other hand, I also was having trouble figuring out what I wanted to do in music. And even if I could get myself to really practice diligently and win a big competition, I wouldn't want to travel the world performing. I still didn't want to be in an orchestra. I didn't want to be in a quartet or a trio, even though I had lots of fun doing that in summer festivals and so forth. And I didn't want to teach. So I was kind of quickly running down the list of things that musicians typically do, and I was finding myself not really drawn to any of them. So there was that. And then I happened to be taking this course that Don Green was teaching on performance psychology for musicians. And I was finding it really helpful. It was changing how I practiced. It was changing how I felt on stage and the results I was getting. But it was also interesting enough that I was finding myself drawn to wanting to learn more. And a part of me was like, well, I wonder if I could do what Don was doing, which is, you know, to work with these musicians and help them learn how to better handle nerves and perform at their best when it really counts. And I didn't know what that life would look like, or whether that was possible, or maybe just something that he was doing and no one else could really replicate. But I was intrigued. And so I talked to him a little bit about it. And when I finished up at Juilliard, it just seemed like that was more intriguing to me than anything else I could think about doing that a musician would normally do. So that's when I decided to essentially put the violin away and see what happens if I went in this other direction for a little while.
I want to go back to something you said earlier about when I asked the question about conflating who you are with mm-hmm. playing the violin. And you said this thing that really resonated with me about feeling like when you didn't play well, it meant you were like a bad person. So for me, like when I had that realization, it came when I had the realization that there was a separate voice saying those kinds of things to me, it was very relatively late. I actually also took Don Green's class. I don't even remember if you and I were in the class together, but I took it at Juilliard as well. And I remember one of the things that I kind of was like a light bulb for me was this realization that there was this critical voice mm-hmm. that was separate from me, but that felt like it was part of me. I guess, I don't know what my question is exactly, but I'm just really intrigued by that, like the sort of persistence of that critical voice and how and if it's connected to mastery. I don't know, because I feel like one of the things that I think a lot about is
what motivates people. Like you said earlier about how early on you weren't super interested in drilling things and like playing things over and over and over again. But from my experience of being trained in the classical music tradition, that was very much how I was trained to practice. And so that there was this constant criticism in my head of like, that's not good enough, that's not right. That's everything was about right. How it wasn't right.
Yeah, and you know, this could potentially be a huge topic to delve into, where it's relevant to what happens in the practice room, it's relevant to who we are and our identity and what happens on stage and confidence and all this stuff. But I think from the very specific narrow area of the practice room and this gap between what happens there and on stage, the thing that I never really thought about or never really occurred to me, even though I think when we talk about it, it becomes sort of obvious that it's all of our experiences, is that we spend a lot of time in what I now call practice mode. And this is where the critic is really valuable. It's, you know, it's where if you take a beginner, you know, they don't know when they've played something out of tune. They don't know what good really sounds like. And so they spend all the time just kind of running things and playing through things. And then they go to the lesson and depend on the teacher to tell them what needs work and what needs improving and what's going well and so forth. And so I think we do spend a lot of time in the early days trying to cultivate this critic in a benevolent sort of way, trying to figure out how we can be our own teachers. But over time, I think it does become more of a critic than a coach, you know, coach being someone who's supportive and helpful and identifies what we can do to make things better. The critic purely just being there to tell us what sucks and what we're doing poorly. Functionally, I think we do need the self-monitor to help us get better at something and help us improve at something that we're working on. But on stage, that's where that voice becomes problematic, even if it's a coach, even if it's a coach saying, oh, that went really well, and that was pretty awesome. And I mean, keeping score in any way where we're doing the self-monitoring tends to make us much more reactive and tends to put us in that place where we're still judging instead of creating each next moment. Paradoxically, we get really good at self-monitoring in order to improve our skill level. And so we get kind of bad at, or we don't really exercise the creative muscle as much on stage, where we just let go and play and create and trust that it's all going to be fine. So we have to be able to kind of switch from practice mode to performance mode, in essence. And we're not really good at that because we don't practice performance mode very often.
Do you think that there are musical traditions that incorporate that performance mode with practice more naturally than, say, in Western classical music?
Probably. And I think I'm assuming what you're getting at is musical traditions where improvisation's a little bit more a part of what they do.
Yeah, because, I mean, improvisation was for a long time part of the classical tradition, and I think is sort of slowly coming back. But in my training and the way it was codified in the last century or so, it sort of fell away. So, yeah, I think a lot about improvisation.
Yeah, you know, there's actually really interesting research that was done at Johns Hopkins where Charles Lim, I believe his name was, studied what's going on in the brain when jazz pianists are playing from memory versus when they're freely improvising. And it's kind of like the brain flip-flops, and the parts that are activated when they're playing from memory are quiet when they're improvising, and vice versa. So yeah, even in classical music, you know, if we're being more improvisational, I think it forces us to be more present and to be more in that kind of creative mode where we're creating each moment, as opposed to trying to recreate or replicate some perfect ideal that we have, and we're constantly monitoring whether we're getting that or not.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I want to talk a little bit about your blog and what inspired you to create this online resource. Especially, how old is the blog now? Is it like 10 years old?
It's getting there. I'd have to look and check, to be honest, because I've sort of forgotten. But yeah, it's nearing 10 years.
Because I'm really fascinated with your story. I really admire the ways in which you've been innovative in your career. And for myself, it's one of the things I find challenging. I feel like I had this idea of what I was going to be as a violinist, and I'm moving past that, and that's really great. But I think your starting the blog is an example of something that I think is incredibly, like, on the outset from my perspective, like, really exciting, but also really brave, because you started blogging when blogging was sort of just beginning to be a thing. Am I correct?
Yeah, and I wish I could remember exactly what year it is. It was probably something like, what is this now, 2018? I think it might have been 2007 or 2009. So blogging was definitely a thing, but it might have been transitioning from something that people did almost more like a diary, which I think was more the case when I was in grad school, to something that people did more publicly on a sort of an educational or informational sort of direction.
And what inspired you to create this online presence for yourself?
So maybe this is sort of typical in that I think a lot of times when we see somebody who's done something that we think is cool, we think, oh, there must have been this light bulb moment or this sort of inspired moment where it took birth. And really, like, the moment that I remember is me, like, on my laptop in the basement where my wife was practicing late at night when the kids were sleeping, kind of futzing around with HTML and, like, a WordPress template and trying to figure out how to create a rudimentary logo with this typewriter font that I downloaded for free, and just trying to figure out WordPress. And my wife saying, you know, what are you doing? Shouldn't you be, like, trying to get clients or, you know, find a way to do a workshop somewhere or something? And I was like, no, like, trust me, like, this is what people do now. Like, this is how you get your name out there and find more clients and opportunities and so forth. And she just kind of shook her head and rolled her eyes. But she knew that I was really into computers. And so for me, it really just started out as, because I'd been reading some blogs and I was learning that they weren't just writing, they were actually getting book deals or, like, making some money from ads and stuff like that. It's like, oh, that would be cool. And I was like, well, if these people are doing it, you know, why can't I do it? And so I did start trying to copy what I was seeing online, but just with, you know, a different topic area that I thought would have been great for me to have if I was still playing and I was, you know, 10 years younger, like in high school, looking for resources. Mm-hmm. And so essentially I just used it as an excuse to play around with a computer and try to create something that I thought would have been cool to have. And the other long-term vision that I had, you know, Don Green, that is, said, you know, I think you should probably write a book at some point as a way to, you know, not just make a contribution, but also to get your name out there and so forth. And so I was like, well, that just seems way too overwhelming for me. But then I discovered this blogging thing. I was like, well, maybe if I do this, then eventually I could take whatever I write over the course of a year or two and maybe turn that into some kind of a book. And so that was my ulterior motive, I guess, to maybe start writing a book in little tiny bits and pieces.
So it's really great to hear you talking about blogging, because that's one of the things that Seth Godin, you know, kind of really is an advocate of regular blogging. And you actually are the person who introduced me to Seth's work. So I'm wondering if you could talk about how his philosophy of small steps done on a daily basis, how that builds a body of work.
Right. And obviously Seth Godin's blog was one of the ones that I started reading. And he was one of the people that was talking about marketing in a very different way than, because, you know, for me, and maybe this is lots of musicians too, when I hear the word marketing or sales, it just feels really icky and gross and slimy. And so I couldn't bring myself to even explore that as an area to educate myself on. And he was the first one who really kind of gave me the idea that marketing isn't about selling, it's about teaching. And that really resonated with me a lot more deeply, and I could kind of get behind that. And so, you know, seeing him write something new every day, and there are other folks, of course, too, who were blogging in the 2000s who really, to me, felt like they weren't trying to sell anything. They were just trying to teach people. And so that's what I think enabled me to kind of get started, because I actually started putting together some websites even before the blog that really to me felt more like selling than teaching. And so that didn't last very long for me, because I just wasn't that enthused about it, and it just didn't feel great for me. But yeah, once I got behind the sort of teaching idea, that really felt much more engaging, even just for me to do it as an activity.
So as a platform for education, it sounds like your website has become, you know, this way for you to reach out into the world. Which of your blog posts or topics or resources that you've developed on Bulletproof Musician have been the most popular? And have you been surprised by which blog posts have seemed to hit a nerve for your followers?
Yeah, you know, because when I first started writing, there was a lot of stuff online about, you know, search engine optimization and keyword research and all this stuff. And I found it intriguing from kind of a geeky technical perspective, but it just seemed really complicated to me, and it made my head sort of hurt. I didn't really want to get into that. And so all I did is I just started writing about things that I wanted to write about that I found personally interesting, or I felt like I just had to say because they were things that had been inside me for a while and I needed to say them. So one of the first things I wrote was about how many hours a day we ought to practice. And in the early days, I didn't necessarily reference research as much as I do now. But so yeah, that was maybe one of the first few things I ever wrote. And no one really read it, because at the time, no one knew my blog existed, and I wasn't very good at letting anybody know that it existed. So it sat there for a couple years with very few people reading it. And then suddenly, I think in 2011, you know, someone shared it in the right circle, and it went kind of nuts. And I haven't looked recently, but I think it was, I mean, it's got Facebook likes in the tens of thousands. I don't think it's tripled. Wow. I don't think it's triple or six digits. I don't think it's like 100,000 likes, but it's up there. And so that's one that certainly people like. But yeah, there. I mean, I stopped a long time ago trying to predict which posts would resonate and which wouldn't, because I just can't. I mean, even now I'll be tempted sometimes to think, oh, I think this one's going to do well. Mm-hmm. And then it doesn't. And then other times I'm like, crap, this one doesn't feel very good. Like, I hope people don't hate it. And then I'll put it up, and then, I mean, the most recent one I can remember is a few years ago, but it was something about eight things, you know, top practicers do, or something along those lines. I can look it up for you later. But I just remember, you know, being late at night, I was like tired. I don't know if it was like 1 or 2 in the morning, you know, early Sunday morning. And I knew I needed to get it out because it goes out at 6 in the morning on Sunday. I was like, crap, like I just can't, I'm falling asleep. I can't look at this anymore. I'm just going to put it out there. I hope it's not horrible. And then, you know, it got thousands of likes, and I was like, well, that I didn't see that coming. It's like, and then I tried to look, and I was like, what are people like finding so interesting about this, or what are they connecting to? And I just can't do it. So I stopped at this point, and I still just focus on, you know, when I find a study that I think is kind of cool and kind of interesting, I'll write about it. And, you know, whatever the search engine optimization stuff or keywords or, like, I don't even bother with that. I never really have. I probably should, but it's not something that excites me very much, so I just haven't.
Along the lines of sort of the unexpected, have you reached any unexpected demographics or groups through your blog that you would never have predicted?
Yeah, so I didn't realize how active a community there are of adult learners. And in hindsight, it shouldn't have surprised me, but you know, these are folks who, you know, from young professionals in their 30s who, you know, were serious about music up until college, but then ended up pursuing something else. But now, you know, have a good job and have some disposable income, and now are like wishing they still played the clarinet or still play the piano. You know, these are some people who might have gone to, you know, like a Juilliard pre-college, or were pretty serious about lessons and summer festivals and so forth, and are coming back to it because they miss it. So from that younger demographic to, you know, folks who are retired or folks in their 70s or 80s even, who some of whom are starting for the first time because, you know, maybe they didn't have a parent who was supportive of playing the harp when they were young kids. And now that they're retired and their kids are grown up, it's like, I never got a chance to play the harp. I'm going to start learning now. So there's a huge range of adult learners who are, you know, very passionate about music and care about it deeply and are really into the learning aspect as well, but who get really nervous or get frustrated when they can't seem to play even at their lessons for their teacher, things fall apart. So that's I think a pretty sizable population of people who really care deeply. And so I've gotten really interested in learning more about them and connecting with them. And a lot of emails I get from people like that, which have been fun to interact with.
That's really inspiring to hear, because I think that at least my experience of classical music and the way I was trained is very youth oriented. And so for me too, it's been, you know, as I've said, I've been really fascinated to hear about your transition out of a more traditional path in music. As I've tried to do things as an adult, I have felt really humbled about being like an adult beginner at things. Are there traits that you notice in people who are successful adult learners? And what might those be? Like, what are the things that you can, that can help you with your mindset to be a successful adult learner?
That's a really good question. And I haven't really thought about it very much or looked into it. I think one of the I don't know how representative this is of the range of adult learners that are out there, but one question, if you'll call it that, that I get over email from adult learners is about whether it's too late. Because I think a lot of them know that obviously they're not going to get to the kind of level that they would if they started when they were five, when they're starting at, you know, 55. But I think they do want to be able to play, you know, to play in a band with their friends, you know, down at wherever they might have an opportunity to, or to play community orchestra or in a chamber music group, and to get to a level where they feel good about how they sound. And the unfortunate thing is there's no way of knowing how good any of us are capable of getting at anything until we've gotten there already. So when I get questions like that, I think I try to steer them in the direction of focusing on growth, so that they're not asking the question of how good can I get, or when can I get to be this good, or will I be able to get this good, but more how can I get a little bit better today, tomorrow, this week, next month, and to track that progress so they actually see that they're getting better. And so they can really get connected more with the growth and feel good about growth, as opposed to whether they've gotten to the end of the rainbow, wherever that might be for them.
Mm-hmm. I think the difference between the growth versus fixed mindset, for me, that's been a concept that's been fairly new. And it's in some ways feels very antithetical to the way I was trained. Mm-hmm. So I can, that really resonates with me to hear you talking about that as a kind of important mindset and skill to develop. Before we leave the demographic thing, do you want to talk about your bagpiping demographic?
Yeah, it's interesting because I've been contacted by some folks in the bagpiping community, and I still don't know a ton about it, I have to admit. I mean, I've worked with a few individually, and I've, you know, learned a bit about it. But yeah, it seems like there's a very competitive and a very passionate group of folks around the world, actually, even in the United States, who are really into competing in bagpipes. And I've learned that the instrument's very finicky and very susceptible to changes in weather and so forth. So there's a lot out of your control, as it turns out, which makes the mental game, I think, even that much more important. So yeah, I don't know what I can say about it other than, like you're saying, there's lots of folks out there in music in different instrument groups who have found a lot of excitement in pursuing music as a hobby.
Actually, I wanted to recommend on the podcast Hidden Brain, there was a recent episode that featured Yo-Yo Ma's Silk Road Project, and in particular followed a woman who's part of that ensemble who's a bagpiper but also a classical pianist. Maybe you'd be interested to hear that.
Well, actually, the one thing that occurred to me as we're talking is, and it's not really in my job description, if you want to call it that, but especially in engaging with more adult learners, it strikes me as like if I could make something happen in the music realm, and not just in classical, I feel like there's an emphasis on trying to, at least commercially, there seems like there's an emphasis on trying to get more people to listen to music. Mm-hmm. And for me, if I had the ability to do this, I would love more people to get involved in doing music, right? So playing an instrument or creating music in some way, even if it's, on a computer, which I don't know how to do, but some people can do really cool things with creating music on a computer with different kinds of sounds and so forth. I feel like if more people would create music, in a lot of ways, they would have a deeper experience of it in a way that maybe impacts not just their life, but other people's lives more deeply.
What are the most important, top three things or skills or lessons that you gained from your rigorous classical music training? And how did they enhance or maybe even hinder your post-performance career and your life path as a psychologist?
Yeah, some of it is probably stuff that I would have to think about to kind of connect the dots. 'Cause I think a lot of it has just been internalized. I guess off the top of my head, if I was thinking about this concretely, one would probably be understanding what hard work really means. I think, you know, when you're a little kid and you're sitting at the window, you know, kind of like tears going down your face because you see your friends just playing during the summer and you know that you can't. And so it's not even worth asking your parents, can I go outside? Because you know that you haven't done your scales yet and you know that, you know, you have a lesson later that afternoon and you're not ready and so forth. And so I think understanding what it really means to work and to have to make sacrifices and to have discipline and to choose things in the moment that you don't necessarily want to do because they're not super fun. But if you don't do them, then the future is not going to be as fun. I think that kind of thing certainly has applied to lots of other things that I've done. I think also having an understanding of what excellent really looks like. So standards of excellence, certainly, because there's no end in classical music to how good something can be. Mm-hmm. It's almost like we just have to stop ourselves based on time and energy and just say, okay, this is where we're going to stop, because there is no end to the rainbow. You can always make something better and more precise and more beautiful and more compelling and more inspired and, tweak a different fingering and find a different way of using your bow. And so I think understanding what perfect or excellent looks like certainly, I think, has transferred over into other things that I've had to do as well. And maybe a third thing would be patience. Just understanding that, yeah, you're not going to be able to learn this piece in 24 hours at the level that you want to. And even something like, I don't remember learning vibrato, but it's something like that that clearly didn't happen overnight, or, you know, particular kind of bow control or spiccato or up bow staccato, something that, you know, clearly didn't happen overnight, or even just kind of working out intonation in a tricky passage, just knowing that your muscles might do it once in practice, but in order to get your muscles to do it consistently, you're going to have to put some time and work into it, and that it won't happen overnight. I think patience is probably maybe the third thing.
You and I were at Juilliard at the same time, which I kind of alluded to earlier, and we did our master's together in the same year. It was funny because I think I've told you this before, but like I only realized that after going back to Juilliard well after graduation, and they had hung all of our graduation
right.
up.
Yeah.
And you and I were sitting with like one person in between us
yeah,
in the front row.
I think it's like Karen Brown and then me and then Clancy Newman and you.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So it's just like, you know, a flashback there.
Right.
You're now on faculty at the Juilliard School and helping the next generation of performers that are coming up and also through your work with the New World Symphony and your many workshops and symposiums and online programs. What are you noticing about these younger performers that are coming up now that are maybe similar to when we were in school and also different? Have things changed? Are they changing?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question, because I think when I answer that question, what I'm doing is I'm comparing what I remember about myself then and maybe some interactions I had with friends who I kind of grew up with students who happen to be in my class. And because my class is an elective, it's a self-selected group of people who might already be kind of different than the norm, if you will. But I don't know. Maybe it's representative of, you know, the larger group of students and the student body as a whole. But one, I think a lot of the pressures are the same, if not more now than they were before. But my sense is, and again, all this is just kind of guessing, my sense is that they're open to other things as well. It's not just, oh, I need to figure out how to get over my nerves and just perform. But I think there's a lot more interest in like Alexander technique and body awareness modalities. There's interest in yoga and, you know, just exercise in general. And I don't know, I wonder if maybe with the internet, we just know more stuff than we used to. Like, you know, because I remember using Google for the first time in grad school at Juilliard. It wasn't even google.com. It was like some Stanford address, I think, and you had to type it in a specific way. And so we couldn't just Google and find the wealth of information that I think now we can, I mean, especially with YouTube and like demonstrations of how to do different things. And remember when you wanted to listen to a recording of somebody, you had to buy it and wait a while for it to come, or go to the store or go to the Juilliard Library and listen to it. And now you can hear all sorts of recordings instantly. And and so I think younger musicians now, I think, know more in a wide range of areas. So they have more resources that you can utilize and maybe are more apt to experiment then with different things. Whereas we might have been more limited in knowing what was possible and what to do. And I don't know. There's I'm sure there's pros and cons to both, but that's what occurs to me.
Along those lines, is there something that you have learned from your work in psychology now that you found surprising or maybe even contradicts some of the things you learned while you were at Juilliard?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The thing that I try to do, so it might just be also the way that I've approached this, but I'm always looking for overlap between what I've learned or overlap between what I know musicians have said and what the research suggests. Partly because I haven't wanted to step on any toes and and make it seem like I'm saying something different than what people have been saying for many years. But for me, I think in general, that does tend to, I'm sure there's some misinformation and stuff that we did growing up that isn't actually the best way to do something. But I also do think that there's a lot of overlap. I remember reading, you know, like going back and reading, you know, some of Galamian's writing, and I think even there was a book that, that Persinger wrote, who, you know, was my teacher's teacher, Juilliard, and a lot of what they write seems really consistent with a lot of what the research suggests. And again, I might just be looking for that overlap and kind of dismissing things that don't, kind of like my own filter bubble. But I think there is a lot of overlap, and that's the stuff that actually excites me more than finding discrepancies. And that even with sports psychology and athletes and coaches, a lot of the most interesting or useful training techniques or strategies often come from athletes or coaches stumbling on something by accident or through experience with one athlete after another, that then researchers take a look at and try to validate or verify if that really works like they think it does. And then if it does, then great. But yeah, sometimes things come out of research. But I think it's really cool when things come out of experience, and then research can either support or clarify what it is that we think might work.
One of my hopes for this podcast is that it becomes the kind of resource that I wish had been around when I was growing up. And it sounds like that was a motivating factor for you and your blog, Bulletproof Musician. What advice would you give to your younger self to help him achieve success and happiness, both as an artist, but also as a whole human being?
Yeah, I don't know if this advice would help me do better. Because, I don't know, for me, I have a difficult time wishing things were different before because it might have led me to be at a different place. Because even the things that didn't go the way that I wanted to back then ultimately taught me something that enabled me to take another step forward in the direction that was closer to where I needed to go. I think the things that I would have said to myself, I mean, this is really probably trivial in the grand scheme of things, but, you know, instead of being so focused on music throughout high school, I think there would have been time for me to play soccer, you know, for my school team, because that's something that, at least when I was in middle school, I liked soccer and I was decent at it. And so I would have liked to think that, so if I could go back, I'd probably tell myself, yeah, you know what, it's okay, just try out soccer for a year. You know, play soccer freshman year, see how it goes, see if you can balance things, you know, maybe try it sophomore year, maybe play all 4 years for that matter. And don't worry so much about the music part of things. But then again, you know, if I did that, maybe I wouldn't have understood sacrifice well enough. You know what I mean? So it's kind of hard, but that's one thing, which again might seem sort of silly, but it's, I don't want to say it's a regret, but it's a lingering curiosity about what things would have been like if I had been able to continue to stay involved in sports a little bit more growing up.
No, it doesn't seem silly to me at all. And it's something that I feel like is one of the things, thinking about a younger version of myself, what I would say to her if I had the opportunity. And I think very often, it's not unique, I think, to our training with classical music, but I think there's an intensity with classical music that somehow can sometimes make you a little bit myopic. And to your point, there are things that are gained from that, but then there are also things that maybe, you know, what would have happened if there had been a little bit more room on that target, you know, instead of the target being the bullseye every single time.
Thank you to today's guest, Noah Kagayama. Be sure to visit his website, bulletproofmusician.com, to learn more ways to reach your peak performance potential. And you can visit my blog, isitrecessyet.com, to learn more ways to cultivate your creative courage and to subscribe to my mailing list. If you liked this episode, please subscribe to Is It Recess Yet on Apple Podcasts and iTunes and share it with a friend. Or write a review and rate this podcast to help build the Is It Recess Yet community and to find like-minded listeners. Thanks so much for listening. Be well and see you next time.